Blog Talk Radio.
Dissolves in awe. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Chuck Thurston, Pamela Chaddock, Andre Rodatis, and Marvin Guerin. Hi, you guys.
Hi, Paul. Hey, good morning, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. So here we are on the last section of Paper 8, The Infinite Spirit. And it just occurred to me, 8 is, if you turn an 8 on its side, it's the symbol of infinity. Mm-hmm. So here we are in Paper 8. Coincidences abound. I don't.
Yes, really. That's right.
They did that on purpose. There was meaning and value in that. So, you know, I have found that you can find meaning and value anywhere you really choose to look for it. So there you go. May your treasures be what you find. That's an old Indian blessing, an old Native American blessing, I should say. May your treasures be what you find. Yeah, it's a good one. I don't know if I ever recited that for you guys, but there's nothing as beautiful and sincere as a blessing. I love a blessing. You know, the Irish blessing, and may the wind be always at your back. That one, that's classic. Anytime we...
May the road rise to meet you.
Yeah, may the road rise
throw gold in front of your feet.
Exactly. Love a blessing.
Oh my goodness.
Such
Andre is a leprechaun.
Well-wished.
I love it.
Yeah, Andre is a leprechaun. That strikes a nice visual image. But anyway, well, this has been a wonderful study, you guys, and I wonder if, you know, if you have any thoughts as we head into the final section of this paper. That strikes you about the conjoint actor.
One of my thoughts is there is more. We're not really done because there's paper 9.
That's true.
Yeah, paper 9 is a good one.
Yeah, relation of the infinite spirit to the universe. Now
and
that
it's
we know,
about the
we've
same
been introduced.
Person.
No.
Yeah.
Even.
So the infinite spirit says, now that you know me, let me tell you all about me. Although he doesn't, of course.
Yes.
It's the divine counselor, but still. We get
how
introduced
much time
to
do
women.
You have?
Yeah, how much time do you have? Infinity.
Well, you know, one thing that's interesting about the infinite spirit to me is that both of those words are nearly incomprehensible. So
that's true.
We have a name for a being that's made up of two concepts, neither of which we can really fully comprehend.
Yes, that's a good
but
point.
Fascinating to think about.
That's
I mean,
a
just
great
the idea
point,
of the infinite. I mean, even as a
it
kid,
is a good point.
Everybody's always, I remember when I was a little kid, the concept of the infinite was so fascinating because you can, you know, the kids hanging around would always say, well, you can always add one more.
Yeah.
And that's what sort of our best idea of the infinite was.
Yeah.
But talk about
and
super additive.
Spirit as a, yeah, and then spirit as a concept is kind of reintroduced maybe in your answer book, a whole new constellation of meaning. So
oh, without a doubt.
Fascinating. Yeah.
The spirit, like you say, it's another concept where you say, okay, so what is...
talking about here.
What is it?
Yeah.
You can feel it. You can sense it. You know it's real. But you can't prove it. It's like God. You know? And yet, I think I told you guys, I asked a friend who is an atheist or tends towards atheism. And she has a soul and she couldn't answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. even when, you know, you try to wrap your mind around it, say, no, well, it's not real. It's a fairy tale, whatever you want to say about God or spirit or any of those religious concepts. They're nonsense, you know. Okay, but do you have a soul? Aha! There's
mm-hmm.
something there. There's
yeah.
something there.
Yeah. What about love?
Yeah.
How do you, yeah. Where's the matter in love? It's
right.
It's infinite. Mm. It's spirit.
Yeah,
yeah.
Those concepts are so hard to wrap. And you know, certainly, the Father. The universal Father, yeah, those are concepts. I get that. Yeah, he's universal and he's a Father, okay. And the eternal Son, okay, yeah, he's just the original creation. He's eternal. He's the eternal Son. I get that. But the infinite Spirit,
yeah,
now we're really right. stretching.
Yeah.
Stretching to infinity with the
yeah.
concept of Spirit.
You know, part of what's interesting to me about God the Spirit, you know, when you think of God the Father and God the Son, they are, in the way we understand the words Father and Son, they're discrete persons. And God the Spirit, we don't think of Spirit as a person. You know,
mm-hmm.
we think of it in a more broad, and the revelators use the word Spirit in ways that they don't do not use the word Father or Son or person or personality. I was just looking at this. It's the second paragraph in the section entitled The Spirit in Man, which is paper 34, section 6. And it's just really interesting. They use the word Spirit in a much more generic I don't know how to say it, multi-manifesting way. Maybe it's the best way to say it. I'll just read this paragraph. Yeah, I mean, the Spirit is manifesting, and God is manifesting in many, many different manifestations or ways. So here's this paragraph. Although divinity may be plural in manifestation, in human experience, deity is singular, always one. Neither is spiritual ministry plural in human experience. Regardless of plurality of origin, all spirit influences are one in function. Indeed, they are one, being the spirit ministry of God the sevenfold, in and to the creatures of the grand universe. And as creatures grow in appreciation of and receptivity for this unifying ministry of the Spirit, it becomes in their experience the ministry of God the Supreme. So mm-hmm. part of what's so intriguing to me about now that they've launched into trying to unfold for us this third person of deity is that both the Father and the Son are discrete beings. Although they manifest in different ways, but God continues to manifest in spirit, which is not a discrete personal influence. It's a broad spread influence in a certain sense, and manifests mm-hmm. in many, many different ways. So it's intriguing. Something different happens with a third person of the Trinity than has happened with the Father and the Son. And the Father distributes himself as well. The Son doesn't really distribute himself, the Eternal Son. The Son creates other sons. And so that's different than the way the Spirit works, which is a broad influence. They describe it as circuitry and a broad influence and sort of pervading all of space. When they talk about the Mother Spirit, the Spirit of the Mother Spirit is pervasive throughout her universe. So the whole idea of Spirit as being diverse in manifestation, but sort of everywhere at once, is very different than either the Father or the Son.
Mm. Yeah, I thought a lot about that too. There's an interesting statement in paper one, actually, that I'm kind of puzzling over in relation to 34:6-2. In 1:3-5, they say God, and they're talking about God here, so anyway, all bets are off probably, but they say God is the universal spirit. God is the universal person. So that's, semicolon, dividing those two statements that are together in one sentence. God is a universal spirit, pervades, like you're saying, but then God is the universal person. And then they say the supreme personal reality of the finite creation is spirit. Reality of the personal cosmos, of course, and they're going to talk about absonite, is absonite spirit. Only on the levels of infinity, only the levels of infinity are absolute, and only on such mm-hmm. levels is there finality of oneness between matter, mind, and spirit. But the main piece in that was just the idea that the supreme personal reality of the infinite creation is spirit. So, there is this kind of, I don't know what to call it, a blending of the personal into the spiritual, or the spiritual into the personal. In some way, but I know what you mean about the concept of spirit in and of itself. The way they talk about it sometimes is not in the way they talk about the Father and Son as discrete personalities. I definitely see that. But yet, at the same time, they tell us that the Mother Spirit is now recognizable. Since the Jubilee of Jubilees and Michael's achievement of Master Son status. I figured, how do they say that? She's now recognizable by all contacting mm-hmm. personalities or something like that, which mm-hmm. suggests a pretty full emergence into personality, even though mm-hmm. she's everywhere. At least that's what they say. She's a pervading presence, which is fascinating, I think. How that
comes. Yeah, she doesn't lose any of the pervasiveness in gaining the personality.
Yeah, personality.
More and more.
Good
yeah,
point.
Yeah.
Whenever I think
word,
of this is the mm-hmm. ideal both end.
Right.
As a conjoint. Mm-hmm.
Right.
I always like the triad: omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. Omnipresent. But it always works better for me in understanding it to say omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. And those three aspects are three aspects of deity. And, you know, it's hard to wrap our mind around ubiquity that goes on for infinity, you know. But that's the omnipresence of God. And that's and we're in it. We are in it. That's how pervasive it is. And we can only separate ourselves from it by an act of our own will and in our own mind. In reality, we're never separated from it, ever. We're always a part of it, and it's always a part of us. But we think we can separate ourselves from it, you know, or we actively try to separate ourselves from it.
Yeah, it's not a great idea, but we have the option.
Well, yeah, it's like a plant separating itself from the soil or, you know, a drop separating itself from the ocean and saying, hey, I'm, you know, an ocean. Yeah, well, pretty soon you'll evaporate. You'll find out that no, you're not. You're going to come back to the ocean anyway, so give it up, you know. It's like a drop saying, ocean, get me wet, you know. It can't be done.
But, you know, there's an interesting distinction. You know, they say the Father distributes himself in his Father fragments, and obviously the Father creates every other person that, you know, whether directly or through the Son and the Spirit, it's the Father that has the prerogative to create persons, either in association with, either on his own or in association with the Son or in association with the Spirit. I think they say somewhere, if I'm, and maybe some one of you probably know where, that the Spirit doesn't really create other beings, other persons, in and of its of himself. That
he
it's the Father. It's the Father in association with the Spirit that creates all the children of the that the Spirit creates all of her children, his her children, does so in conjunction with the Father. But the Father fragmentizes, right? And the Son, I mean the Spirit, is an influence that's pervasive and everywhere and really, in a sense, threaded through us, threaded through our nature, through the circuitry of mind. But they say, what's really interesting to me is they say the Son does not really split off himself in any way, whether it's through fragments or through circuits. What the Son does is the Son is capable of creating other separate beings. But the Son's presence is always discrete. So the Son is the most personal of the, meaning a distinct entity that's circumscribed. Anyways, I'm sorry. That's just a feeling I have, and it's hard to put into words. But they do say that the middle person of deity is discrete and singular and non-dividable in a way that the Father and the Spirit, they're not limited in that way. They can self-divide in certain sense.
Fragment.
Yeah, fragment or it's through circuitry, they're ever-present. But the Son doesn't do that. And we are sons. There's significance for us because we are sons of God. We're discrete personal beings. We can create or co-create other personal beings, but we can't share ourselves in any other sort of dividable way. We remain singular.
Yeah. Well, we do have the Spirit of Truth, but that's a circuit. They call it a circuit, but it's also the presence of Michael.
But they say that's dependent on somehow that's really layered into the nature of the Mother Spirit in order.
The Mother Spirit is, she's manages that presence.
Well, she makes it pervasive, I think.
Right, through her nature. Mm. Yeah, right, exactly. So that's an interesting complemental function that they have. By the way, in the next paper, in paper 9, they will get into, I think it's the last section of paper 9, actually, we'll get into third source personalities, which is a whole interesting thing unto itself.
But, well, let's get going then.
Let's get going then, yes.
We've got a reading to do before that.
Yes. But in any case, when we get there, we can maybe puzzle out this thing about how they say that all personality comes from the Father. But then in paper 9, they talk about third source personality that comes from the third source. So how that all works together will be interesting to ponder.
Mm-hmm. Well, who wants to read section 6?
It's deeply. Well,
I can. I'm glad to
read it. Go ahead, Marvin.
So this is section 6, personality of the infinite spirit. Do not allow the widespread bestowal and the far-flung distribution of the third source and center to obscure or otherwise detract from the fact of his personality. The infinite spirit is a universe presence, an eternal action, a cosmic power, a holy influence, and a universal mind. He is all of these and infinitely more, but he is also a true and divine personality.
Mm-hmm.
The infinite spirit is a complete and perfect personality, the divine equal and coordinate of the universal Father and the eternal Son. The conjoint creator is just as real and visible to the higher intelligences of the universes as are the Father and the Son. Indeed, more so, for it is the Spirit whom all ascenders must attain before they approach the Father through the Son. The infinite Spirit, the third person of deity, is possessed of all the attributes which you associate with personality. The Spirit is endowed with absolute mind. Quote, the Spirit searches all things, even the deep things of God, close quote. The Spirit is endowed not only with mind, but also with will. In the bestowal of his gifts, it is recorded, but all these works that one and the selfsame Spirit dividing to every man severally and as he wills. Here, read that again. But all these works, I don't quite know how to read that, but all these works that one and the selfsame Spirit, maybe honor, but all these works that one and the selfsame Spirit dividing to every man severally and as he wills. The love of the Spirit is real, as also are his sorrows. Therefore, grieve not the Spirit of God. And that's also probably a biblical passage. Whether we observe the infinite Spirit as paradise deity or as a local universe creative spirit, we find that the conjoint actor is not only the third source and center, but also a divine person. This divine personality also reacts to the universe as a person. The Spirit speaks to you. Quote, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says. The Spirit himself makes intercession for you. Spirit exerts a direct and personal influence upon created beings. Quote, for as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God, close quote. Even though we behold the phenomenon of the ministry of the infinite Spirit to the remote worlds of the universe of universes, even though we envisage this same coordinating deity acting in and through the untold legions of the manifold beings who take origin in the third source and center, even though we recognize the omnipresence of the Spirit, nonetheless, we still affirm that this same third source and center is a person, the conjoint creator of all things and all beings and all universes. In the administration of universes, the Father, Son, and Spirit are perfectly and eternally interassociated. Though each is engaged in a personal ministry to all creation, All three are divinely and absolutely interlocked in a service of creation and control, which forever makes them one. In the person of the Infinite Spirit, the Father and the Son are mutually present, always and in unqualified perfection. For the Spirit is like the Father and like the Son, and also like the Father and Son, as they too are forever one. And that's the end of paper 8, presented on Urantia by a divine counselor of Uversa, commissioned by the Ancients of Days to portray the nature and work of the Infinite Spirit. A lot of stuff in there.
lots to ponder.
Say about an absolute mind and an infinite spirit, is there? Where do you start?
What can you say about such infinity? Yeah.
Well, one thing that grabbed me was the idea. I can't remember whether I read it in here in this particular section, but it's this idea that the Spirit is absolute only in mind, and yet we're talking about the Infinite Spirit. So I'm curious about that, because the Spirit couldn't be not an Infinite Spirit, but what is it about the absoluteness of Spirit in the Eternal Son that makes that not emphasized in the Infinite Spirit in the same way? I mean, obviously they're doing very, very different jobs.
Do you have a reference for that?
Do you have any thoughts about that? Pardon?
Yeah, I'd like to look at the passage where they talk about the Infinite Spirit being absolute only in mind. Do you remember where that is?
Yeah, I just saw it, and then it went away, but
well,
I will look for it.
This statement I think you're thinking of is more limited. It's paragraph 3 of the section. It says that in
Spirit
I just
found it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Spirit is endowed with absolute mind, but there must be other stuff in other sections.
No, there's
that.
Another one that talks about
that.
No,
it comes up in paper 9, actually. Well, here's one place. They say the contouring creator is absolute only in the domain of mind, in the realms of universal intelligence. The mind of the third source and center is infinite. It utterly transcends the active and functioning mind circuits of the universe of universes.
Creative Mother attenuates that infinite mind for us. And then adjuvants are...
Right.
That can plug into us.
In an animal
but isn't it curious
body.
That the name they give to the conjoined actor is the Infinite Spirit? That's the one. That's how they title these two papers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if a spirit is infinite, how then is it not also absolute? Parsing by making that statement, and you know, we'll have a chance to discuss that when we get into that passage later, but it just struck me. I thought I would bring it up because it relates to this idea of personality and what you were talking about before, Chuck. You know, the fact of personality and spirit being so important and intertwined, and yet personality seems to be a superordinate quality, a superordinate reality, actually. Something that does something with spirit, mind, and matter that spirit, mind, and matter can't do with personality. Spirit, mind, and matter can't really impact and change changeless personality, but personality is doing with its will all it can with spirit, mind, and matter. And I think in that quote that you gave that talked about the supremacy of spirit, I mean, it really was alluding to, in some ways, the finite, but it was also alluding to what our experiences with spirit, we don't approach the Father through matter. We don't approach the Father through mind. We approach the Father through spirit, because this is what allows us to progress. The dynamism of spirit somehow is what creates the growth situation, whereas our attachment to matter does not. And even in the absentite, it seems that spirit is at least slightly dominant, if not completely dominant, over matter and mind, even in transcended phases. So it's only on the absolute level that they have parity. And there you can kind of understand it, because in the section on paradise, they'll tell us, paradise monoda are unitary systems of reality, you know, like they're stationary systems of reality. And I'm paraphrasing very, very loosely here. Paradise spirit and paradise monoda appear to be the same or equivalent or something on that order. And we can hardly tell you, we can hardly define something for you that we can only differentiate in name. So on that level, matter and spirit somehow have an equivalency. So just bring that up in the context of your previous discussion, because in this age and for ages to come, our means of progress is to approach spirit, and to do that through our will, which is only there because of our personality and because the Father bestowed it on us. And that's perhaps one way of understanding that passage.
So my way of kind of approaching what I think you were asking us when you began to your sharing, Andre, which my way of trying to understand what you're asking us is how are each of the three special or unique in a certain way? And if it's mind, if it's mind for spirit. And so for me, if that is what you're asking, for me, how I approach that, what is it that's special about each of the three that the other two may have a part of, but they're not the epitome of it? So for me, the question is one of epitome. What does each person of the Trinity epitomize in a way that the other two do not? And so for me, the Father, the epitome of the Father is the origin of everything, number one, and the creator of everything. Everything flows ultimately from the source. That's what they call the first source and center, from the originator of the Father, right? Which is not true of the Son and the Spirit. They originate and create, but they do so derivatively in a sense, because it's the Father that created them, right? So the epitome of the Father is origin and creator, and also ultimate destiny. He's our destiny in a higher way than either the Spirit or the Son are. And the Spirit for me, and the Son, when they say it theologically that the Son is the Word, you know, the Son for me is the ultimate expression or embodiment of the initial creative urge of the Father. So the Son is the epitome person. He's distinct, he's boundaried. The Eternal Mother Son, he/she, is the original full embodiment of a personal being that the creator person originally made. Mm-hmm. So that's what epitomizes the Son. The Son is discrete. The Son is not broadly distributed. The Son doesn't the Son is a singular person and only replicates by making other sons, you know, other created beings, whereas the Father and the Spirit replicate in a different way. They can fragmentize and distribute themselves and be a pervasive influence. So what epitomizes the Spirit in a way that is not epitomized by the Father and the Son is this manifestation of mind, which is a pervasive circuitry throughout the universes, and action and execution of the plans and the purposes, the will of the Father and the Son. And so the Spirit is manifestation and pervasive influence in a way that the Son is certainly not, and in a way that the Father is not, because the Father delegates everything. The Father doesn't do everything. The Father hands it out and over as a ministry of grace to both the Son and the Spirit. So that's a little long-winded, but again, how do you epitomize it? Father is creator and origin. Son is the ultimate person and embodiment and discrete, and Spirit as a broad, pervasive mindal influence and spiritual influence and executive influence in the universes.
So here's another way to think about Spirit, and this is one of my favorite ways to think about Spirit, as life. And the book intimates this. And the Spirit is the life giver. And Jesus, I think, referred to the living water. Whenever he said that, I think that's a Spirit. The living water is a Spirit. And there's a couple of paragraphs that really speak to this. One is from paper 34-2-5. It says, in the creation of a universe of intelligent creatures, the creative mother spirit functions first in the sphere of universe perfection, collaborating with the sun in the production of the bright and morning star. Subsequently, the offspring of the spirit increasingly approach the order of created beings on the planets, even as the suns grade downward from the Melchizedeks to the material suns, who actually contact with mortals of the realms. In the later evolution of mortal creatures, the life carrier suns provide the physical body fabricated out of the existing organized material of the realm, while the universal spirit contributes the breath of life. And then another paragraph on the same thing, 36.6.4, when the life carriers have designed the patterns of life, after they have organized the energy systems, there must occur an additional phenomenon. The breath of life must be imparted to these lifeless forms. The sons of God can construct the forms of life, but it is the Spirit of God who really contributes the vital spark. And when the life thus imparted is spent, then again the remaining material body becomes dead matter. When the bestowed life is exhausted, the body returns to the bosom of the material universe from which it was borrowed by the life carriers to serve as a transient vehicle for that life endowment which they conveyed to such a visible association of energy matter. So breath of life only comes up five times in the book, but it's interesting that you know, that's what the Spirit contributes. And I was struck by the fact that when you read, Marvin, this section, that we first achieve that. We first achieve the Spirit. Then we go on to the Son, then the Father. And each one sends us through. So the Spirit is the initial to makes sense, because as we're being brought up as little spirit embryos in this universe, the whole goal is to get us to be full-fledged spirit beings, right? That's the first achievement.
I saw the image of the Spirit being a web, casting a web, catching us. It's like the Spirit is what catches us first. That's what I was picturing, the way you were describing that, Paula. So I don't know if that's...
Yeah, kind of like the mind circuits.
Yes. Yeah, it's like that's the initial...
If I'm understanding what the book's saying, she's the one that gives us life. When they say in energy, mind, and matter, one of the many wonderful things we'll be able to do, all of the things we'll be able to do, but never will we be able to provide one spark of life.
You know, the more generic the more generic term for me, Paula, of which life is one way of describing it, is really, and this is just my way of holding on to the concept, is the concept of energy and the term energy. That the spirit is the distributor and she is the source of all energy, material energy, all forms of material energy like electricity and life force is a manifestation of her energies, but she also has energy that is of a mindful nature and of a spiritual nature. So for me, love is a form of spiritual energy. Right, it's motion, it's potency, it's drawing power. All of those things for me are associated with energy, it's living force in a sense. So when they describe the creation, the initial creation of our local universe, they talk about her. It's all through the spirit that the mobilization and coalescing of energies and devolving of energies down into eventually matter, and the energy of mind, the movement, the motion of mind through circuitry, all those are energetic manifestations, including the energy that is originated in the Father and is given through the spirit of life, as you say. The spirit is the I don't know how to say it, not the encircler of life, but the transmitter of life.
Yeah, the deliverer of life.
The deliverer of life, the birth giver, in a sense.
Yeah.
So, but I think of it more generically as energy, because energy you can think of as physical energy and mindful energy that courses through the mind circuits, and also spiritual energy. And for me, the manifestation of spiritual energy is epitomized in love. Love is the spiritual energy of the Father moving through the sons and through the Spirit.
It's
back
spiritual
into
currency,
the Supreme,
isn't it?
Back
it's the currency
into the Supreme. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Paula mentioning the Spirit as life, earlier I had looked up the definition of Spirit online, and this was a nice, I thought this was a really concise description. In Wikipedia, it says, in philosophy and religion, spirit is the vital principle or animating essence within humans or, in some views, all living things. So I thought that was another cogent description.
That's beautiful.
You know, it is beautiful. It's concise.
Well, here's the... And that's spirit, right? Talking about spirit.
Yes.
Here's an interesting little bit of definition that kind of complements that, maybe. This, again, is in the next section, in section 9 of this paper. But paper 9, section 4, actually. But, you know, I like it when your answer book sort of gives us definitions. Anyway, they say, this is in the fifth paragraph, they say cosmic force responds to mind, even as cosmic mind responds to spirit. Spirit is divine purpose. It's like, okay, there it is. Spirit is divine purpose, and spirit mind is divine purpose in action. So the spirit is the God of action. Energy is a thing. Mind is meaning, and spirit is value. Even in time and space, mind establishes those relative relationships between energy and spirit, which are suggestive of mutual kinship in eternity. So, you know, we've got body, mind, and spirit. You know, the first things you learn in the Urantia book, it is this division of reality into these three realms. And here they're talking about how they have mutual kinship in eternity. And I think that speaks to their origin and purpose. But this notion that spirit is divine purpose, I don't know, I'd have to sit with that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But we know we get our values from spirit and meaning from mind. And those combine the you know, all these potentials with the material level as well, the energy level. So seeing, seeing meaning and seeing meaning and value, all get function.
That's really fascinating, Chuck.
Yeah,
the,
that's
the
a good
whole
one.
Idea of purpose as being associated with spirit, and what it says to me. When I think of purpose, it's natural to link purpose with values.
How about with action?
With action and with values. When I think of matter, I don't think of values. When I think of mind, actually, I don't actually think of values either. I think of ideas or concepts. And of course, they say the realm of values is the realm of spirit. And purpose is teleological, meaning it's headed toward an ultimate end goal, right? It's moving somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's moving toward its end point, that it's its destiny, in a sense. That's what teleology means. It's a study of destinies, theologically. And so it's fascinating that spirit would have threaded through it purpose in a way that mind and matter don't have. That's really interesting. It's directional.
And think about that in relation to life. Life, then, is purpose. The spirit is purpose. The spirit is life.
Yes.
Well, and it's inextricably interwoven with the will of God, right? The idea of purposiveness, what God wants. And psychologically, what's interesting is how we speak about it psychologically is motivation, right? What do I want? What do I intend? How do I use my will? What am I reaching for, striving for?
What's my purpose?
What's my purpose? Mm-hmm. What's my direction? You know, where am I going?
Mm-hmm.
All these ways of understanding purposiveness. And for me, all that is wrapped up in the central construct of the will of God and our will marrying up with God's will. And that's just fascinating that's really associated with spirit.
Yeah. And that's the next paper we're going to be reading. That's in paper 9. But if you think of, here's a great triad. Energy is thing, mind is meaning, spirit is value. There's a wonderful triad there. Actually, two of them.
Oh, yeah.
And they're married together.
Absolutely.
Energy, mind, and spirit, thing, meaning, and value.
You know, well, look
I
at the next
part.
Go ahead, it's worth looking at the next little paragraph there that follows that one. This is 9.4.6. They say the mind transmutes. Now, that's an interesting word. Mind transmutes the values of spirit into the meanings of intellect. Volition has the power to bring the meanings of mind to fruit in both the material and spiritual domains. The paradise ascent involves a relative and differential growth in spirit, mind, and energy. The personality is the unifier of these components of experiential individuality.
You know,
but that,
to me, all of this is speaking to our power as the children of God. How powerful we really are.
Yeah, good point.
You know, and how empowered we might be if we just took these things up and not let anything take our power away. You know, like it seems to me that Jesus always was about empowering the individual to know who he is, to know the value he has, and the ability
he
possesses.
Having life and having it more abundantly. I mean, talk about life, you know, that's what he said.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I get overall in this discussion, and it's thrilling to me. We're really powerful. We have everything at our disposal. And I don't mean powerful to say, you know, sure, you know, we can lord it over each other and make each other suffer. You know, there's a power in that. But I mean power to do good.
Yeah.
And that when we really step up
empowered
to this purpose, nothing could stop us, really, if we hold on to that authentic power, which is,
you know,
the whole Trinity is empowering
us. Paragraph 4, you know, talks about you know, whether we observe the infinite spirit, blah, 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 it goes down to this divine personality also reacts to the universe as a person. The spirit speaks to you.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, he who has an ear, let him hear what the spirit says. The spirit himself makes intercession for you. So it's like, it's a very engaging situation here. And then I've always loved this quote, for as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God.
Mm.
And that says to me, my sheep know my voice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
the sheep have learned to trust the shepherd. So, I don't know, I just had to emphasize it because it was interesting because when I first found the Urantia book, and I was also going to a Pentecostal church at the same time. yes. Talk about a dichotomy. But it was also very spirit induced. The theology was a little limited, but I was getting into the Bible. And so certain quotes just jumped out at me, like, taste and see that the Lord is good. Oh, I love that. Okay, I'm going to use that one. But this one, for as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. That one jumped right out at me.
Yeah, that's,
so,
that's a keeper.
That's a beauty.
It's a keeper. Yeah. So anyway,
I love those.
Just how... It's a personal thing. The Spirit speaks to you. He who has an ear, let him hear.
Go ahead, Jack, and then Marvin. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was going to say, one of the ways the Spirit speaks to us, you know, in quotes maybe, is through the urges of the Adjutant Mind Spirits.
Mm.
You know, we get these urges to do things, to manifest, to create, you know, to express our life on the seven levels. And that wouldn't happen without those urges. Without those urges. In other words, if it was just left up to us to decide to do those things without the urge, it never happened. It's like the spirit is the source of motivation, you might say. You know, the motivation to make things better, the motivation to fulfill your potential. You know, all the
positive motivations
that are so crucial all flow from these urges of the action mind spirit.
Right. Yeah,
which
are then
crowned,
of course, with action, the conjoint actor.
Yeah,
there
right.
it is. There's that action that's coming down. It
initiates action through urges.
Right.
But then our personality has to endorse that and say yes.
And do it.
But
yeah. And do something.
Yeah, right. And that's where the will comes into play. But
yeah, I'm glad
you
mentioned that.
And then, of course,
it's
crowned by the Holy Spirit and the thought adjuster and the Spirit of Truth, you know, eventually. But that's how it all starts.
Let me tie in with the third paragraph. You know, the Spirit searches all things, even the deep things of God, and it goes on to say, in the bestowal of his gifts, it is recorded, but all these works that one and the self-same Spirit, dividing to every man severally and as he wills. I thought that was a curious exploration. What does that mean? And I think you hit on it when you talked about the adjutants, Chuck, because we individuals are reacting to the different adjutants depending on our needs or, you know, our challenges or whatever. So, I wanted to talk about that line. And when you said the adjutants, that really opened that up for me.
Well, before you do, before you throw that question out there, though, I want to go back to Marvin because, Marvin, you still have your thought?
Yeah. This goes back way back to what Chuck was talking about with the idea of purpose being endemic to spirit. And what it made me, we were talking about will and volition and how central that is in the function of personality. And it made me think of this section in the Adjuster and the Soul, where they talk about the slow and gradual shifting of the seat of identity and the function of the human will out of the mind and into the soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pardon me. Yeah. So the passage is 111:3-2. During life, the mortal will, the personal, you know, because you were talking about purpose, right, Chuck, as essentially a spiritual phenomenon, direction and purpose.
Mm-hmm.
During life, the mortal will, the personality power of decision choice is resonant in the material mind circuits. As terrestrial mortal growth proceeds, this self with its priceless powers of choice becomes increasingly identified with the emerging Maurantia soul entity. After death and following the mansion world resurrection, the human personality is completely identified with the Maurantia self.
Mm.
So what they're saying is there's a transfer of purpose, of deliberative, you know, of will function in our life. Temporarily, it's resident in the minds, primarily in the environment of mind, but that's a temporary embryonic situation. In the next life, it gets lodged where it's destined to lodge, which is in the soul part of us, and the mind becomes attendant to and participative with the soul, which is the value sensing and the valuing part of us. The spiritual part of us, the nascent spiritual part of us, it's just forming in this life. In the next life, it's the center. It's the seat of identity, of personality. It's the seat of consciousness and the seat of will. And they say an interesting thing. They say that a mortal being cannot be reconstituted in the mansion worlds without a thought adjuster. Here, a person can function without a thought adjuster, but not in the Maurantia life. The soul is not capable of functioning other than in association with a spirit fragment of God, and so that's pretty profound, you know.
That's hugely profound.
Yeah, they're saying that purpose or direction or decision making is destined early on to be lodged in the spirit, the emerging spirit part of us, not in the mind per se. The mind, conceptually and ideationally, is meant to be in service to the purpose-finding and valuing part of ourselves, which, you know, that's happening for us in this life as we grow spiritually. More and more, I think all of us sense this, that it's our spiritual values that really begin to guide our mental and ideational functioning. Whereas for people who haven't developed that, they're primarily driven by concepts, not by values, you know, or by matters, physical urges, you know, alone. Yeah. That's it.
Just this upcoming paragraph. No, I just want to expand on what you're saying. Also from 111, paper 111, in that same section 3, the fourth paragraph, kind of picks up the theme you're talking about, where they say that both the human mind and the divine adjuster are conscious of the presence and differential nature of the evolving soul. The adjuster fully, the mind partially. The soul becomes increasingly conscious of both the mind and the adjuster as associated identities, proportional to its own evolutionary growth, talking about the soul. The soul partakes of the qualities of both the human mind and the divine spirit, but persistently evolves toward augmentation of spirit control, which is kind of what you were just saying, Marvin. Persistently evolves toward augmentation of spirit control and divine dominance through the fostering of a mind function whose meanings seek to coordinate with true spirit value.
Wow.
Exactly.
So,
that's the unfolding of the underlying purpose that you were talking about earlier,
right,
which is the driving force. It's where it's going. It's its destiny. You know, it's to be spirit-driven. And
the soul is the vehicle for all of that. Yeah.
And the soul slash adjuster, because, you know, I mean, early on, the soul fuses in the personality. There's a fusion between the soul entity and the associated mind circuitry mm-hmm. with that father fragment, and we become mm-hmm. one being. Which, mm-hmm. you know, all that for me is threaded throughout. It's wound up with this whole sense of purpose, meaning teleology. Where is it going? What's the end mm-hmm. goal of all mm-hmm. of this?
Yeah, origin, history, and destiny.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The end goal is spiritual, fundamentally spiritual. And matter and mind are at the service of spiritual realities and values. So it's amazing
yeah,
stuff,
yeah.
really.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Pam, do we want to go back to your question about on
oh.
from paragraph 3? But
oh,
all
I
these
don't know.
Work,
I just
the spirit is endowed
see,
not
which
only
was
with
that?
Mind. Well, she just wondered what our take on this was. The spirit is endowed not only with mind but also with will. In the bestowal of his gifts, it is recorded. But all these works that one and the self-same spirit divided into every man severally and as he wills. Didn't you want to talk about that, Pam? Or maybe I misread it.
Well,
I think we all kind of got
no,
hung on that.
You're,
one a
it's
bit.
What we've been talking about, actually. So.
Well, but,
well,
yeah,
so
you
understand what they mean. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Chuck opened that up for me. I was hung up on the dividing to every man severally and as he wills. And it's like, you know, selectivity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the adjutant forces really opened up that
oh, yeah,
for me.
Oh, yeah, severally?
Because,
huh,
yes, severally, yes. And
mm-hmm. yeah, yeah.
And yet the spirit is determining, is zeroing in on each individual what that individual needs. And so perhaps that's when the angel's spirits come in to minister for what that individual needs. See, so that's the severally
mm-hmm.
and as
mm-hmm.
he will.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's,
well,
and that's where
and
personality comes in. That suggests the personality, too, because the willing personality of the spirit to be specific
uh-huh.
with each of the children.
Right, yeah,
it's very beautiful.
Yeah, and that quote is really expanding on the prior sentence, I think, where they say the spirit is endowed not only with mind but also with will.
Right.
So we
right.
associate will and, with personality, so they're this
yeah.
spirit. So
and the bestowal of
that,
his gift.
And that's
yeah,
how it is utilized.
Is endowed not only
that's...
with mind but also with will. And so this ministry mm-hmm. is a conscious will, willful
conscious,
ministry,
yes.
you call it.
Conscious,
yeah,
there you go.
Personal, knowing, very knowing
mm-hmm.
bestowal of gifts mm-hmm. or something like that.
Marvin read that twice, and I can see why, Marvin, because the syntax seems strange, doesn't it? But all these works, that one, and the self-same spirit, you know, I don't know for sure what.
Well,
what they're.
It's not a complete. It's not
well,
a complete sentence. It's more of a.
Is it? It's more of a fragment of a sentence. Is that why it seems like it's bad syntax?
Yeah,
comma
probably.
After works, comma after works. But all these works that one and the self same spirit dividing to every. Well,
and
anyway.
They divide to every man severally.
Yeah.
It's the dividing. That's what the syntax gets a little strange there.
Who wrote that? Somebody in the Bible wrote that. What were they getting
Bible
at?
Guy wrote
so that was that I just looked it up, and that's from Corinthians, you guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And
okay.
and
yeah.
The quote is, but all these worketh, that one and the self-same spirit, dividing to every man severally as he will.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes on, for okay. as the body is one and hath many members, and all of the members, you know, blah, blah, blah. get into a biblical reading. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's for all. But the quote from Corinthians 12:11-31, but all these worketh that one and the self-same spirit, dividing to every man severally as he will. Yeah, it's just an interesting statement.
What was that again, Corinthians?
You know, there's two ways. There's
Corinthians
two ways
12:11-31. Sorry, Marvin, go ahead.
That's okay, thank you.
There's two ways to understand the word works here. One is as a noun and the other as a verb. And it's interesting because in the Corinthians, it's used as a verb. But I actually think that the way they're using it here, it makes more sense as a collective noun, meaning a number of works.
A number of works, yeah.
Yeah, works or actions or end results, right? So if you read it that way, and not as a verb, right? So all these works, meaning the things that the Spirit does, that one and self-same Spirit, dividing to every man severally and as he wills. That then the sentence makes more sense and is in keeping with what Chuck was saying as the sentence before. So if you read it, the Spirit is endowed not only with mind, but also with will, meaning intentionality or purpose, in the bestowal of his gifts is recorded. But all these particular works, the Spirit dividing into every man severally, and as he wills, is moving toward a singular purpose. Then, right. Then it makes sense, yeah.
And here, dividing.
What was so difficult reading it is I kept trying to read it as a verb, but it doesn't. The sentence doesn't work as a verb.
Okay.
It works as a noun, as a collective noun.
It's a noun,
yeah. It's a set of works.
Right, but all of these works, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I like the analogy of the adjutant mind spirits. And, you know, then the idea of as he wills, to me, says, and again, back to how powerful we are, we can open those channels bigger. We can open those channels to the adjutants within ourselves much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And receive more abundantly those gifts. That's the as he wills part, right?
Mm-hmm.
We get to decide. What are we opening to? Are we just surviving? I mean, that statement that you said, Marvin, about, you know, we have to have that thought adjuster up there, but we don't down here. Well, animals don't have to have it either, and they survive. But then if we're going without it, then we become an animal of
right.
the realm.
Yeah,
and if we're ignoring that,
no eternal
that still
component.
Small, yeah, that eternal component, then we're no more an animal. But the adjutants work too. The adjutants work in animals too, but only two are human, and that's worship and wisdom.
Worship and wisdom.
And I think especially we can open up those channels much broader. You know, certainly, though, we can cultivate all of those gifts from the Spirit, the gift of courage, the gift of counsel, right, the gift of intuition, all of those.
Like all of that is then wrapped up in the mind. The world. We have more onto mind.
Right.
All of that is combined together in a unification that can function to body. The dividing into seven with the fact that we're in an evolutionary animal body, so that the Spirit has to make contact with these physical forms kind of incrementally or evolutionarily. And with this all seven, culmination of that one at a time to evolve, you know, the way it does. So this mechanism can make contact with Spirit. I mean, that alone is a achievement of design.
Yeah.
You think about the life carriers or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Very interesting, Chuck. The have to aspect is an interesting thing that caught my attention in what you said. I've looked at it that they designed it that way, you know, that they want it to. There's a differential, right, that even probably harkens to depth psychology in human beings and personal mind typology, let's say, where they talk about the 4 and 20 types of psychic organization. There's something you can do with the adjutant mind spirits and the two hemispheres of the brain and get there with that. But the have to is interesting, that this could also have been that they get to their result of wanting to have this differential in mind type by making sure that mind can progress through one or the other or some combination of the adjutants progressively, that this is the approach. It's not just an approach of desirability. It's an approach of necessity in order to make it work.
Mm.
Interesting thought.
Yeah, yeah.
Appreciate the thought.
Yeah, I think so. Well, then they say that the Holy Spirit is our first super mind endowment. So the functioning of the seven adjutants is what enables our reception or connectivity or whatever you want to think of it with the Holy Spirit, which again they describe as our first super mind endowment. So it's like mm-hmm. kind of then you know, then the thought adjuster. The Holy Spirit prepares our minds for the reception mm-hmm. of the thought adjuster.
So here's the
I just want to give a metaphor for what's been shared. I see the whole adjutant beginning as the bottom of Jacob's ladder. That's what Jacob's ladder is to me, is this whole progressive, purposeful extension spirit.
The ascent.
Yeah. So that's all.
Huh.
Well, Jacob's ladder is fun, but I kind of prefer Jack and the Beanstalk.
I think we go with Jack and the Ladder myself. But
yeah. Okay. Jack o' lantern.
My thought. Jack o' lantern. My thought actually is very, very synergistic with what you just shared, Pam. I found that the paragraph in the personality survival paper where it says that the soul cannot function without adjuster association. And it's very interesting. It caught me a couple of months ago when I read it. I had never really focused on it before, so it was kind of new to me. I think you'll like this, Chuck. It's the kind of stuff that, you know, you like it. You like this, you want, too. It's one.
I like that paper, for sure.
It's 112.6.7, the first sentence, couple of sentences. And it's very related to what you were talking about, the bottom rung, Pam. Mortal mind prior to death is really interesting wording. Mortal mind prior to death is self-consciously independent of the adjuster presence. Adjutant mind needs only the associated material energy pattern to enable it to operate. So in other words, you know, you can have a pre-adjuster human being, right? No adjuster, mm-hmm. but mind is still operative. An animals too. But worship and wisdom can function without the thought adjuster. The capability is there. But the next sentence is what really caught me. They say, but the Maranscha soul, being super adjutant, does not retain self-consciousness without the adjuster when deprived of the material mind mechanism. In other words, upon awakening in the mantra worlds, where the adjutants are not really functioning anymore, the adjutants are threaded throughout material, our material mind mechanism, our brain in a sense, our animal evolved brain. But in the next state, when we awaken, there are no super adjutants. There are no adjutants. Our mind is a super adjutant form of mind, and it does not retain the soul. Does not retain the ability to function, to be conscious, much less have volition, without the adjuster in that state. So that's really fascinating. So that we are dependent for our mental, our consciousness and our volition to be in association with a father fragment from that point on, intimately. And so it's like what you're saying, Pam, is, in the mantra worlds, that bottom rung has disappeared. It's no longer there for us. We're in a different rung.
Mm-hmm. We have a whole new ladder.
It's an escalator.
We get a whole new ladder. We get an upgrade. You know, I just want to, for the sake of our listeners who may not have a book and or may not know exactly what the adjuvants are, I want to share that. But I also want to say thank you, Pam, for putting these quotes up on the chat board. It's something that people who never come and join the chat wouldn't know, that whenever you guys and Andrea has done this a lot too, whenever we quote a reference in the Urantia book, a paragraph, Pam or Andrea will put it up on the chat board, and it's really nice. It's really helpful to be able to read it and go back to it as we're discussing it, because we do bounce around a lot.
Great.
But
yeah,
the Urantia book is it has so many cross references, and you know, it's just so divinely woven, so consistent in its fabric. I mean, it's just to me, you know, that those golden threads go all the way through, and so it's nice to track them. And I just want to read what the adjuvants are for our listeners who may not be aware. The seven adjuvant, this is from paper 34410, so that paper is about the local mother, universe mother spirit. That's her paper, an astonishing paper. It says, 34410, the adjuvant mind spirits are the creation of the divine minister of a local universe. These mind spirits are similar in character, but diverse in power, and all partake alike of the nature of the universe spirit, although they are hardly regarded as personalities apart from their mother creator. The seven adjutants have been given the following names: the spirit of wisdom, the spirit of worship, the spirit of counsel, the spirit of knowledge, the spirit of courage, the spirit of understanding, and the spirit of intuition, of quick perception. So they kind of define that for us. It's almost like they're saying, okay, we know you might misunderstand what we mean by intuition, but we're telling you it's the spirit of quick perception. And, you know, what strikes me is we're talking about these adjuvants, and even if you, like, do a search for the spirit of, they use that term a lot, the spirit of truth, the spirit of quick understanding, the spirit of, you know, various different things. And so the spirit, when used that way, is interesting to me. The spirit of wisdom. What is the spirit of wisdom? And when you look at these adjuvants, when you look at wisdom, worship, counsel, knowledge, courage, understanding, intuition, here again are seven things of great import, you know. Pay attention. Mm-hmm. Because I think that
you can
many
substitute
times,
purpose.
The purpose of wisdom, the purpose of counsel. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Or life, the life of wisdom,
meaning to
the life of counsel, the life of courage. You're giving these things life by your own free will, by an act of your own free will. You're embracing wisdom, worship, counsel, knowledge, courage, understanding, and intuition. And, you know, I've always thought that the chakra system is a primitive way of describing these spirits. They recognize them. The early humans recognized these spirits, and they called them the chakra system. And, you know, so they align them with the human body, which to me, the mind is the whole human. It's not just the brain. It's the whole being, right? It's everything. Mm-hmm. The mind impinges on everything about us that we are, our humanness, our body. And these adjuvants come in through different places, and they line up very well, I think, with the chakras. For instance, courage would be the gut chakra, you know. Mm-hmm. And even in our language, we'll say, well, you don't have the guts for that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Counsel is the voice chakra.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's
urge
a lot of
insight.
The urge to communicate. You know, and if you've gone up through them all, you communicate with knowledge, with courage. And it goes the other direction with wisdom and worship. And, they're just these spirits.
That,
go ahead, Chuck.
Say, it's interesting that the spirit of them is the highest adjective. I think it would be the spirit of worship, but it's not. It's the spirit of them. Think of that as the fifth of wisdom, in a sense. Then being the highest chakra, it's sort of the view from above.
Yeah.
Just
yeah,
how we
because you can't
obtain wisdom. It's sort of looking down on the whole system.
Yes,
be sure
you can't
it's
be wise.
In a unified way.
You can't be wise without worshiping.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Worship
yeah,
is necessary
so,
for wisdom.
And wisdom is the crown.
Wisdom, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and
so,
they talk about worship wisdom in that
mm-hmm.
interregnum paragraph that we always
yes.
go back to.
Yeah, worship wisdom, mm-hmm. right.
Worship wisdom,
mm-hmm.
they even hyphenate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think in a certain sense, the highest wisdom only comes as a result of connection with deity, you know, so that
mm-hmm.
there's input
yeah.
from the spirit. Yeah, that's why I think the
yeah.
worship
from
comes
the wisest
before,
of
before,
all. Oh,
before
perfect.
Wisdom.
Oh, yeah.
yeah.
Yes. You're connecting with mm-hmm. infinite wisdom then. And
mm-hmm.
and for me, it's keyed into insight mm-hmm. then. And it's someone who's insightful, for me, this is what wisdom means to me. Wisdom is an understanding that's transcendental. It's so it's powerful in that, you know, wisdom is like, I just can't describe it any other way, you know. It's like a transcendental understanding. And people who are wise understand their fellows, right? They understand. They don't have to be shown specific motivations and whatever because they've been around, they've given it enough thought that they see that everybody has a story. And the wisdom comes in when they try to understand the human condition. This is just human. And I'm talking about human wisdom, right? Because we're all trying to understand. God's wisdom is, you know, obviously for all aspects of creation. But for us, you know, we can apply wisdom now to our fellows, right? In understanding them. And when we're wise, we realize that there's consequences to actions. And, you know, it just, to me, wisdom is, when you hear it, you know it, right? Jesus was the fount of it. Jesus was the ultimate fount of wisdom for me. And if I want to access the Father's wisdom,
mm-hmm.
I just listen to the words of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
That's the and that's mm-hmm. that wisdom is what allows us to forgive each other, I think, for being human. Wisdom takes everything in.
Son.
You know, I'm fascinated with wisdom, you guys. I guess
yes.
you can tell.
No, that's good.
You have to define it, though. How do you define wisdom?
Well, I appreciate you bringing up wisdom. It's I want to give you this particular quote because it gives all of us an interesting spin on wisdom that we might not otherwise have. In the context of talking about the ministering spirits and specifically about talking about the Supernafim, they have this wonderful statement, and I've put it in the chat, 26:117. These brilliant creatures of light are sustained directly by the intake of the spiritual energy of the primary circuits of the universe. Okay, they're talking about Supernafim, whether on Paradise or in Havona. Urantia mortals must obtain light energy through the vegetative incarnation, but the angelic hosts are encircuited. They, quote, have food that you know not, end quote. They also partake of the circulating teachings of the marvelous Trinity teacher sons. They have a reception of knowledge and an intake of wisdom much resembling their technique of assimilating the life energies. Which reminds me of Keanu Reeves in The Matrix saying, know jujitsu. I know jujitsu. So, I mean, my goodness, you can imbibe wisdom on that level.
Mm. Yeah.
And what does
yeah.
that mean in terms of its encirclement in the mind of the infinite spirit and how knowledge is organized, even in a living organization? So, yeah.
You know,
well, you know that's
when you ask
that's...
about...
Go ahead, Mark.
When you ask about when you ask about Wiz Paula, what immediately comes to mind for me is, and I've always thought about this way, and that's why I think they link wisdom and worship, and why the sequence is first worship, and then the capacity for wisdom in terms of the adjutants and how they come on board. That for me. Wisdom has always been a marriage or an amalgamation of pure spiritual revelation or inspiration amalgamated with living human experience. So we accrue wisdom as a result of applying the inspiration that comes from worship, but applying it in life, we learn some additional things as a result of the application of those values that come from worship. And revelation, there are things that we only garner by trying to put them into effect in life and learning what works and what doesn't work. And that is the painfully, as they put it, the painfully garnered accumulation of human wisdom. It's experiential. It's inseparable from actual experiential application of spiritual values and ideals that come in worship. And so for me, wisdom is also very associated with progress through the psychic circles, meaning that because one of the things they say is that someone who's advanced in the circles is not only spiritually connected with God as a son of God, and so that's a pure spiritual advancement, but they also they have an impact in the world increasingly because they become more capable in the application of the spiritual principles in living experience. And for me, that is all captured in the term wisdom. And so it makes sense that worship wisdom is a conjoined reality in a sense.
It also taps into the idea of supremacy as they relate it to that effectiveness. We know that Jesus became more and more effective as he, you know, attained the psychic circles, and that there's a certain amount of interassociation through the personality of both your mind and spiritual elements, but your ability to impact your material environment that way. And clearly, I mean, Jesus got very good at that, but they also indicate that the 24 counselors, the Gerasim citizens who are part of the 24 that have been included there, have attributed to supremacy on this world. And they've done so. They must have made their circles in order to do that. They did it in such a way that they have, what am I trying to say here? They were effective in their groups, however large or limited they were. They affected either a full culture or a full race or whatever it ended up being. Whether it be John the Baptist, whether it be Porchunta or Orlandoff or whoever it was, they affected their people and hence got onto the Council of 24. And there's something about as we make our circles, we become more effective. you know, I'm talking about this specifically because Gina on the board, Pam noticed as well, you know, is put a number of quotes there and wanted to see, you know, and ask the question, how do, first of all, with respect to the idea of destiny, does it make sense as we consider all the influences, speaking Father, Son, and Spirit, to include reflection on the role the Supreme plays in our eventual goals? How does the influence of the Father, Son, and Spirit interplay with the influence of the Supreme? I'll just say, Gina, more will be revealed. No, I'm not going to do that to you. but we are getting there, and I would suggest that as we get to paper 10, which I can't see that we're not going to do that after paper 9 at this point because it brings it all together, and dealing with the Trinity, that we won't be dealing with this more and more. But it's an excellent question. And so you've got these quotes from 117.58, 117.65. Shall I read them, is it too far a departure?
I just want to interject one
right
thought
now?
About the
go ahead.
That occurs to me. Mm-hmm. And it came to me as we were having this conversation today, and about the, you know, someone was talking about the Jubilee and how the Mother Spirit becomes more. Becomes a person more contactable. I think the same thing is happening with the Supreme. And it's the same phenomenon. It's the pattern on a higher level. It's the same pattern. And it's like all of us, high and low, are becoming more. Because that's the watchword of the universe, is progress. So how can any being, high or low, not be a part of it? We are all evolving and becoming more. And the Supreme is evolving and becoming more. And as each local universe reaches supremacy, the Supreme is then that much stronger. And that new age will be the birth of that new divine creation. But just like us, we are actualizing our personalities becoming more spiritual. Becoming stronger, becoming more viable, more real. We're actualizing just like the Supreme. And we are, in a sense, we are the Supreme. But at that age, the Supreme will be like the Mother in the Jubilee of Jubilees. She'll be fully actualized. And then
interesting to look at this, the positioning of the Supreme in God the Sevenfold. The Supreme is the gateway to the paradise beings.
The gateway.
In our experiential development.
Yes.
Yeah, just kind of circling back to the whole wisdom question, which is where this sort of thread of conversation began, and wisdom being experiential accomplishment out in the world and that being associated with circle attainment. I found these two passages in the section on the seven psychic circles, which are very related to everything we're talking about. It's 110.6.16, paragraph 16, and then again in paragraph 19 of that section. So they say these circle attainments are only relatively related to God consciousness. A seventh or sixth circler, which is the early stages, can be almost as truly God-knowing, sonship conscious, as a second or first circler. But such lower circle beings are far less conscious of experiential relation to the Supreme Being, universe citizenship. So that's really interesting. And then on paragraph 19, it says in the middle of the paragraph, actually the whole paragraph. There is only an indirect relation between cosmic circle attainment and actual spiritual religious experience, which is consistent with the earlier statement. Such attainments are reciprocal and therefore mutually beneficial. And here's the key thing for me. Purely spiritual development may have little to do with planetary material prosperity. But circle attainment always augments the potential of human success and mortal achievement. So there's a there's a marrying up here for me of the application of spiritual values in living experience and the kind of learning we garner as a result of putting spiritual values to work in life and learning what works and what doesn't work. And that to me is the accrual of wisdom, actual experiential wisdom. Yeah. And so that all that makes a lot of sense to me. And the psychic circles is about the accrual of wisdom. It's the accrual of the application of spiritual values in our lives, in living experience.
Effectiveness.
Yeah.
Is another word.
I want Andre to be able to read those quotes that Gina posted. But I just want to also offer this wisdom from the definition of wisdom from Wikipedia. I think you guys will appreciate. Wisdom, sapience, or sagacity is the ability to contemplate and act productively using knowledge, experience, understanding, common sense, and insight. Wisdom is associated with attributes such as unbiased judgment, compassion, experiential self-knowledge, self-transcendence, and non-attachment, and virtues such as ethics and benevolence. Wisdom has been defined in many ways, and there are several distinct approaches to it. So I thought that was...
You know, that's
that was,
really... That's a great, what a great description. And I was really struck by the word sagacity because I've always, it's stuck in my memory. One of the things they say about why Melchizedek came to work with Abraham, when they say they were looking at the genetics of the Abraham's family for several generations, and they foresaw that in that particular generation, there would be born to this particular family offspring that had a number of qualities that they could foresee. And one of them that characterizes Abraham was sagacity, which is the capacity for wisdom. That's really interesting, which made him a much more effective individual in making things happen out in the world, which is what he and Melchizedek did together. You know, why they were so effective together is because of his capacity for wisdom. And it's what's interesting is that they say that's a genetically related capacity for wisdom. Very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was a good definition, actually. Mm-hmm. Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Yes,
and interestingly, Wikipedia is a compilation of the wisdom of many, right? So that, I like Wikipedia for that reason. But anyway, Andre, I wanted you to go ahead and if you can read those paragraphs or that Gina posted on the board.
Oh,
you can read the whole thing,
8.
Actually, if you want her.
Just
I'm there.
Gina just said, I just think it's important to understand how the Supreme is also shepherding us through our ascension, not just the Trinity. So, thank you, Gina.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The way we're walking, right? Taoism and Transcendentalism both, you know, in the East and the West, you know, had their finger on that pulse of the Supreme and the experiential nature of evolution and its rootedness in God.
Yeah, and Whitehead also.
And Whitehead also. Well, thank you. Yes. Don't want to forget Whitehead. And so it is with the spiritual circuits. Man utilizes these in his ascent through the universes, but he never possesses them as a part of his eternal personality. But these circuits of spiritual ministry, whether Spirit of Truth, Holy Spirit, or Super Universe Spirit Presences, are receptive and reactive to the emerging values in ascending personality, and these values are faithfully transmitted through the sevenfold to the Supreme. That was 117.58. Then going to section 6, paragraph 5 of the same paper, the Mirantia soul of an evolving mortal is really the son of the adjuster action of the universal father and the child of the cosmic reaction of the supreme being, the universal mother. The mother influence dominates the human personality throughout the local universe childhood of the growing soul. The influence of the deity parents, and she puts parenthetically my note, universal father and the mother supreme, becomes more equal after the adjuster fusion and during the super universe career. But when the creatures of time begin the traversal of the central universe of eternity, the father nature becomes increasingly manifest, attaining its height of finite manifestation upon the recognition of the universal father and the admission into the core of the finality. And then two more little quotes. 117.68, three paragraphs later, all soul-evolving humans are literally the evolutionary sons of God the Father and God the Mother, the Supreme Being. And then circling back to two sections earlier, 117.49, herein lies the great cosmic responsibility of self-conscious personalities, that supreme deity is in a certain sense dependent on the choosing of the mortal will. So with all of that in mind, I know you're all compiling this because you're just in-circuited, you're imbibing wisdom right now directly from the font of the circulating wisdom of, anyway. Just recapping the questions. With respect to the idea of destiny, does it make sense as we consider the influences to include reflection on the role of the supreme in our eventual goals? And how does the influence of the Father, Son, and Spirit interplay with the influence of the supreme? So I leave that to you, brilliant people.
Gives you a sense about what the Father's goal is.
Here's one more.
Go ahead.
One more. Yeah, one more short passage in that section, 117.6.26, which has always stuck with me. And it relates right to what you were saying, Paulo, what is the Father's purpose? This is such an interesting statement when they're talking about the God is our Father, the Father God, and then the Mother, the God, the Supreme, is our Mother. And this is 117.6.26. It's at the end of that section on the quest for the Supreme. They say, when you find the Father, you will find the great cause of your spiritual ascent in the universes. When you find the Supreme, you will discover the great result of your career of paradise's progression. So God the Supreme is our Mother, and she is the grand total accumulation of wisdom, experiential wisdom, that has been garnered throughout this universe age. And in my way of thinking about it, God intended the evolution of the cosmic spiritual family, and the Supreme Being, when she is complete, as our Mother, will be the full expression or the full summation or embodiment of our spiritual family. She will be the spiritual family in living form when she's complete.
Mm.
That's incredibly powerful theology, I think.
Oh, man. Mm. Unprecedented. Really.
Mm-hmm.
On this world. Paper 117, you know, is so important. Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that really delves into the Supreme as God the Mother in that middle section, you know. Halverson likes to point out that it's right smack in the middle of the five Supreme Papers when you understand that paper 119 is also one of the Supreme Papers, which of course it is, because it tells us how Michael achieved supremacy.
I like to think of, I really like to think of myself as having four parental God figures who are my spiritual parents, functionally. Not just theoretically, but they're functioning in my life as my spiritual parents, right? And I think of the Father, God the Father, and God the Supreme as, in a sense, my grandfather and grandmother. and God and Jesus, our local creator father, and our mother spirit as my father and mother more immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And those to me are four living, experienceable. We can experience their ministry to us as our spiritual parents, and they're loving us and raising us up in multiple ways. So for me, God the Supreme is very, very palpably our universe mother, our grand universe mother.
I would love if we could talk about paragraph four before the end of the show.
Let's talk about the spirit.
All right. The love of the spirit is real, as also are his sorrows. Therefore, grieve not the spirit of God.
I saw that too.
It's like, that always jumped out at me over the years. And so the Hebrew root for grieve, which I cannot pronounce, but it communicates a mixture of divine indignation against sin and a heartfelt anguish concerning the plight of his creation. Is that? God, that gives me chills. Thus, in grief, God responds in judgment against sin. This is from, I think, of Genesis here. Thus, in grief, God responds in judgment against sin, yet bestows saving grace and mercy on Noah and his family. That was from Genesis. But
interesting.
What a beautiful description, a mixture of divine indignation against sin and a heartfelt anguish concerning the plight of his creation.
It's tucked in there, as Marvin would say, right, in the top of paragraph four. The love of the Spirit is real, as also are his sorrows. Okay, and then you reflect on the fact we're talking about an infinite absolute being, the third person of deity, has sorrows. And elsewhere they do talk about the deity's suffering. They know that the eternal Son and the Spirit suffer. They imagine that the Father suffers, but they do not know how.
Here's one for you, Andre. The very first sentence in paper 110, which is the relation of adjusters to individual mortals, an incredibly significant paper. It's a single sentence, first paragraph, right? We're talking about emphasis.
I know the one.
The endowment of imperfect beings with freedom entails inevitable tragedy. And it is the nature of the perfect ancestral deity to universally and affectionately share these sufferings in loving companionship.
Wow.
Boy, that's
the story
so
of being a parent right there.
Well,
it speaks to the parental nature of God.
Truly. And his tolerance and his willingness to let us learn, to let us learn, even if those lessons cause us to suffer. I will, it's like Jesus saying, I can't promise you if you follow me, you won't have trouble. In fact, I can most assuredly promise you if you do follow me. Yeah, it's a sure pathway to trouble. But I can say that I will go with you through it all. That's it.
We'll be with you.
We've all suffered. We've all been in the dark night of the soul where we have struggled mightily, and one tragedy or another, life is full of them. Into every human life, some rain must fall. And what they're saying is God shares that with us on the most intimate level. God is saying, I'm here with you. I understand. I feel your pain.
I want to help you through it. Get over it. Help you find a better way. Right.
Yeah.
Here's
really
a quote that comes to mind for me, how the spirit might suffer. And it brings it down to the level of angels. This is from 113:5-2. Angels are so near you and care so feelingly for you that they figuratively weep because of your willful intolerance and stubbornness. Seraphim do not shed physical tears. They do not have physical bodies, neither do they possess wings, but they do have spiritual emotions, and they do experience feelings and sentiments of a spiritual nature, which are in certain ways comparable to human emotions. So while we can't compare mm-hmm. what might grieve the spirit, they give us an example right here, willful intolerance and stubbornness. You know?
Yes. Thank you for
an
those.
Unwillingness. Yes. Yeah. To move. I always think of that, you know, settling down complacently. And what does that mean? You know, settle into the fact of who you are, where you're going, what is required of you, what is needed of you, you know, your responsibility. Settle into these things complacently. Stop fighting it.
Yeah.
Just enjoy it. Move with it. You're standing against the tide. That's only going to wear you out. Settle down. Just so meaningful to me. Willful intolerance and stubbornness. What, Chuck?
I'm going to say that opening line from that adjuster paper, how the ancestral deity just, you know, that's a, it's in the theodicy. Ranch book. Get on to the thing about theodicy for a while.
Yeah.
It's like,
don't just throw out terms and not define them.
That resolves
that. I know that Byron Bellizzo says, but go ahead and do it for our audience.
Yeah, what is theodicy? You know, I know what it is, but go ahead.
Theodicy is a theological exploration of the question of God is good, how can there be evil in the world?
Right.
Yeah, and suffering.
It's a big conundrum.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
There's been debate about this forever. One line, it really helps to resolve it, I think. Saying that, we're going to suffer. The spirit's evil by our side and experiences all of that with us. That's not like we're just thrown to the wolves, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
Kindness.
Evolutionary
purpose, you might even say. One other piece of that only comes from, just to finish that thought, there's one other piece to the theodicy of the Arantia book that can only come from revelation, with the existence of the central universe. God has already created a perfect universe, you know, where there is no evil. He's been there. He's done that. What we're experiencing is kind of the next stage in universe unfoldment. We do experience these things, but along with that, God is always with us, experiencing these things with us. Like a huge, I think.
To get over evil as an act of our own will, to overcome it. Go ahead, Martha.
It is huge. It is huge. And the first part of the sentence is as powerful as the second part of the sentence. The setup is all about theodicy. It's all about why is there evil. And they just tell us in one set of phrases, the endowment of imperfect beings with freedom entails inevitable tragedy. Boom.
Boom, mic drop.
There's no mystery. There's no mystery here for us.
There's no mystery.
It's set up. God did this intentionally for God's own growth and your own growth, your own contribution to the Supreme, so many things. And the vision I had just while we were talking about this is, you know, these celestial personalities sitting around and putting together this revelation. And someone came up with that sentence, right? Some being came up with that sentence. And I could see a bunch of them going, oh, yeah, we got to put that right at the beginning.
Put that right on.
And say nothing else. We're going to put that in a sentence all by itself because this is a jewel of truth.
Mm-hmm. It sums it up.
It just
talk about a razor. That one cuts right through.
It's absolutely archetypal. It's an archetypal theological statement. Yeah.
Well, and here's and in that is a response for us when someone says, well, if God is, you know, and why is there suffering? And you could say, well, are you perfect? Because if you were perfect, then you would never do anything that caused anyone else to suffer. But no, you're not perfect. And because you're not perfect, you will inevitably do something that will either cause you to suffer or cause someone else to suffer. It's just that simple. It's that simple.
Yes.
When you're
right.
perfect, you won't do anything that won't. Yeah.
Well, you know, and it's suffering so useful. But I feature myself, you know, in a conversation with someone, and someone asks that question, and it's like I almost want to pull out my phone and have that passage on the phone app right there
yeah.
and say, here, just read this sentence, and then let's
yeah.
continue talking, you know.
Or commit it to memory.
Well, yeah. There's,
well,
it's short enough. There's no way to explain it more clearly and lucidly than that sentence.
Right. Than that.
Yeah.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
Well, and there is a full circle aspect to this thread that is part of the teachings that may not be stated as succinctly anywhere, but there is this idea that this particular age and this finite creation is all about the opportunity of slowing down the process of creation sufficiently that individuals within it have the ability to co-create themselves and contribute to the growth of the universe in a way that would not happen were growth to have happened by fiat, as it did
mm-hmm.
in the first age. Those
yeah.
Havona natives can't contribute other than to be what they already are. What we can do
right.
is actually choose to become the values that make this universe what it is. And that is an unusual aspect. And that is an act of love on the part of God. And that's what we need to understand.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
one of the responses to, you know, the theodicy argument of,
mm-hmm.
you know, or question.
So it's
not, only making
wrapped up with origin, history, and destiny.
Right.
Yes.
I was going
to
say, we're not only making
the
universe what it is, we're making
yeah.
it what it's becoming. Yeah.
Is God
yeah.
also growing?
Yeah, clearly.
Well, and it's a gift. It's a gift.
The Supreme
to us.
Is.
Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, God is giving us. Yeah, God is giving us this opportunity. It's a gift to us.
It is a gift to
How
us.
How about?
Viva la gift.
Is the,
viva la opportunity.
Is the existential God growing?
He must be.
Oh, now, just wait a minute. Now we're getting to absolute stuff, the experiential existential, where it's going to be a while before we get to 104, 105, and 106.
Okay. And we have 30 seconds left.
There you go. That's
well, let's just answer the question. In a manner of speaking,
our time
perhaps.
Is running out.
In a manner of speaking, perhaps.
See, this is our cliffhanger for next week.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yes.
No promises.
Well, we're on
next week is going to answer it.
Week, and we're down to our last 90 seconds. Yeah.
So paper 9 ought to be a dandy. Hope you guys can join us. That's going to be the relation of the infinite spirit to the universe. And then paper 10, the Paradise Trinity. I guess that sums up the first 10 papers. But thanks, you guys. What a great discussion. Wow. You know, it's just so thrilling. You know, I'm of a mind to say, well, let's just read the whole book together, shall we?
Yeah,
it'll
right.
take us
keep
20
going.
Years, but we hopefully still be around in 20
well,
years.
Continue. Yeah, it's not a bad idea. Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, anyway, guys, thank you so much. Thanks to all of our listeners. Hope to see you again next week. It's always a delight to see you on the board. Hope you enjoy the program when you're listening on the archive. And to all of you, my dear friends, have a wonderful week coming up. Happy President's Day. If you
That's
mm-hmm.
right.
celebrate.
President's Day is coming up.
Yeah.
Washington's birthday. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Love you guys.
To our founding fathers.
Be well.
Yes, our founding fathers. Yes.
Yeah.
Have a good week.
I love you. Okay.
All right.
Bye for now.
Love to all.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.